Hi, everyone, and welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Sophia Simonello.
And I'm Nick Rohrkraut.
And today we have a very fun episode planned. I just returned from the Cannes Film Festival, and we will recap my experience, the winners from the fest, which just came out yesterday as of recording, and talk about maybe what this means for Oscar season and the rest of the year in film.
I was so jealous to see all of your photos and you thankfully updating us on what to see or maybe what not to see. So I'm excited to hear all about that. I was trying to keep up with some of the news. I think just we were both looking forward to Sentimental Value and that being at the end of the festival, really being a big cliffhanger in a way, but getting to enjoy other things. My parents also were on a trip and happened to be in Cannes for a day, which was amazing, made me more jealous, but they got to experience at least seeing the Grand Lumiere outside, the beach, all of the fanfare of the festival, which was great. I told them to go to McDonald's on that little square. So I do really miss the experience. Hopefully I can go in the future again, but I'm excited to hear about your experience and we can talk about the winners too, because I think some of those are well known and that really excites me for the year ahead and their releases to the public.
Yeah, we definitely need to go together in the future because we've gone separately now multiple times. So we need to make sure that we go together and that our time actually overlaps because it is, as you know, I mean, just such a fun, glamorous experience. I mean, I didn't participate, I will say, in the glamour. I didn't do any red carpet galas or anything like that. I mostly just did the regular screenings, but it's just a completely different world and really unlike, I would say, any other film festival. And I really tried, I think, to make sure that I got to see films that who knows when I'll get the chance to see them. But yeah, I know you and I had talked about Sentimental Value as a big one for us. And I think leading up to it, that was the one that was just on my mind. I was seeing all these other films and some of them I did really like. Some didn't hit me as hard as I wanted them to. And then that one came and we will talk about it. But let's get into our winners first. So our big winner, our Golden Palm or Palm d'Or, went to It Was Just an Accident from Jafar Panahi. Our Grand Prix, which is second prize, went to Sentimental Value from Joachim Trier. Our jury prize was a tie between Sound of Falling by Masha Shalinsky and Surratt from Oliver Lax. Director went to Kleber Mendoza-Filho for The Secret Agent. Actress went to Nadia Maliti for La Petite Dernière. And actor went to Wagner Moura for The Secret Agent.
And then for screenplay, we had Young Mothers by the Dardenne brothers, Jean-Pierre and Luc. For the special jury prize, Resurrection by Bigan. The Uncertain Regard winner went to The Mysterious Gaze of the Flamingo. And the Camera d'Or winner, which is the prize for Best First Feature, went to The President's Cake by Hassan Hadi. And the Camera d'Or special mention went to My Father's Shadow by Akinola Davies Jr. The Queer Palm went to La Petite Dernière, which you mentioned earlier, and the Palm Dog, our favorite prize, went to Panda, the Icelandic sheepdog in The Love That Remains. Did you see that one?
I didn't. I missed that one. I'm sad to miss the Palm Dog. I think looking at this list, these are pretty good winners. I was happy, I think, especially with the Palm d'Or and Grand Prix winners. Those were two of my favorites from the entire festival. And Sound of Falling, I saw that on the second day of the festival. It's a German film that I'll talk about in a minute. But I think overall, these winners are a pretty good representation of the competition films. And you mentioned In Certain Regard, that's one of the sidebar sections of the festival. So the festival has the main competition section, which is made up of films that are all competing for the Palme d'Or. But then there are a lot of other places where you can see different films. So you have the Cannes premiere section, the out of competition films, which are where things like Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning play. They're not competing for the Palme d'Or, but they're having screenings and galas anyway. In Certain Regard is a great section because a lot of first-time filmmakers showcase their films here. So this is where Harris Dickinson's film Urchin premiered, Scarlett Johansson's Eleanor the Great, Kristen Stewart's directorial debut, The Chronology of Water. So this is a really good section, I think, for some new discoveries. There's also Critics Week, Director's Fortnight, which is also where one of my favorite films from the festival premiered. So yeah, lots of great opportunities to see films that you really never know when you're going to get to see them, maybe ever again, because a number of them don't have a distributor yet. So I think when I was thinking of the films that I wanted to see at the festival, I did try to, you know, see a lot of films that were in the competition section, but also I tried to spread it out a little bit too, so I could see some ones that no one had ever heard of before that might not come out. I think back to my first time going to Cannes in 2021, and I saw a film there called Onoda, which was by Arthur Harari, aka Justine Triet's husband and writing partner. And I thought it was this really beautiful, dark, deep film, and it didn't come out like for years. Mm-hmm. It was a long time until people got to see it. So I think I tried to make sure that I saw a good variety of movies. But of course, there were some things that I missed, regrettably, that I'll have to catch at other festivals or when they're in theaters in New York at some point. But yeah, it was a great experience. I'm so glad that I got to go again.
Yeah, talking about films from previous years, we mentioned The Palme d'Or. Last year, this film, Black Dog, won, and it won a prize in Un Certain Regard as well. And I'm like still trying to find that. And I think it's being released soon. But yeah, it's just that slow process of acquisition and getting them viewed by distributors or people and then eventually audiences. So yeah, I think we will still continue to see these coming out apart from the competition films and some out of competition ones. The one I have seen that we won't talk about today because it was one of those, and I always think of Indiana Jones from previous years because that was an Oscar nominee. But Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, I did see. I had a great time at the movies, and it is a long one, but it's in wide release and IMAX. It's wonderful filmmaking happening. Stunt work by Tom Cruise. Too bad this didn't come out in 2 years when he probably would have won an Academy Award for Best Stunt Ensemble. You know, maybe there will be a post-Final Reckoning and he'll come back once again, because him flying in a plane and seeing the effects on his body too, and then him underwater, were absolutely fantastic and some great cinematography work also.
Well, I'm glad to hear your positive review on it, because I actually skipped this at Cannes. It was playing and I want to see it, but it was one of those things where I just thought, okay, this is literally out in theaters next week. I'm going to see something else and then I'll just save it for when I get home. So I'm going to see it tonight, and
totally
I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be my return to American cinemas, as mm-hmm. Tom Cruise would definitely support. I'm going to get a big popcorn, large Diet Coke, and just enjoy Tom Cruise tempting fate in whatever stunts he's doing. I heard there's one where people are actually shocked that he didn't die. So I'm excited to see what that is.
There are a few. Some are quite comical also, and there have been some negative reviews, but I think you know what you're coming for, and it really is a summation of the series. There are a lot of Easter eggs too, and clips, montage clips from past villains, including Philip Seymour Hoffman. So it was cool to see those along the way. Another one that is being released very soon is The Phoenician Scheme by Wes Anderson. Did you see that one, knowing that it's coming out?
I did see The Phoenician Scheme. I think because it was in competition and just one of the big films of the festival, I really wanted to see it. And I think also, you know, Wes Anderson, he's a Cannes staple. He's premiered so many of his films there. So I felt like it was one I had to see. So yeah, even though it's coming out soon, I was really eager to check it out. And I do think that this film in structure is closest probably to something like The Grand Budapest Hotel. So I think fans of his will probably really enjoy it. I kind of left feeling a little bit cold and wanting more from it, but I think there are great performances in it. Mia Threapleton, who is actually Kate Winslet's daughter, she has a lead role in the film. She's pretty fantastic, I think, and really steals the show. Michael Cera, he plays this character Bjorn, and I was shocked that he had never worked with Wes Anderson before because I feel like he fits so perfectly into that world. And I think Adam Stockhausen's production design in particular always stands out. And this is, I think, one of Wes Anderson's most beautiful films, but it didn't have the lingering effect on me as some of his best films, I think. So I am going to see it again, though, I think, when it comes out here. And maybe it'll have more of an impact on me when I've had more sleep.
Yeah. Well, I saw Asteroid City when that premiered at Cannes. It was my last film, the final morning of my trip. I figured I could sneak it in before I took the train back. And I kind of had a similar feeling to, I feel like, what you're saying about this. And I know you liked Asteroid City a lot, but I feel like I can see some of that in the trailer of what you're saying. So I'm really kind of split on checking this out, but I probably will end up in us talking about the film in some way. But yeah, it's a little disheartening.
I enjoyed my time, and it could just be a reaction that I've had to some of his films of late, where I had it really, I think, with The French Dispatch, where I just left and thought, maybe this just isn't for me. It's stronger than that, and there are some actors who have particularly great comedic moments in it, but I didn't get that like knockout feeling that I think you get from some of his best films, like The Grand Budapest Hotel, or for me, like Asteroid City, where it just felt like this rumination on grief. And here, I'm not thinking about it anymore. And I think that's a problem, potentially, because some of the films from this festival, like the endings are just playing over in my head, or the opening scenes, or I'm thinking about particular performances. And that one just wasn't as big of a standout for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some of your highlights then, and some of your favorites of the festival. Obviously, I'm most interested in these and whether you think they'll be a good fit for me as well. But I loved hearing all the praise. And yeah, just go through maybe your top five or some moments that you really enjoyed, either just generally from the festival or in your movie-going experiences.
I'll actually start with the Palme d'Or winner. It was just an accident, the Jafar Panahi film. So I think him winning the Palme d'Or makes a lot of sense, because this year, with Juliette Binoche's speech at the beginning about Palestine, Palestinian journalists, with the way Robert De Niro spoke about Donald Trump, you could just feel this lingering quality and this idea that cinema as resistance or as political activism was very important. So for someone like Jafar Panahi, who was imprisoned and dealt with the Iranian regime for a very long time and finally was able to make a film critiquing that in this way, it makes a lot of sense. I think that he won the Palme d'Or, especially, like I said, given those themes and the important feeling that was going on at Cannes this year. It is a knockout film. I think that this has the best ending of the year of any film that I've seen so far. And it is absolutely haunting. There's a beautiful ambiguity to it that will kind of stun you a little bit. It reminded me of how I felt when I saw the ending of The Zone of Interest or something like Killers of the Flower Moon, where it just kind of punches you in the gut and makes you think differently about everything that you've just witnessed in the previous hour and a half. It starts out very simply. This man is in the car with his wife and daughter, and he accidentally hits a dog. It was just an accident, he says. His car starts experiencing trouble, and they have to stop at this auto shop to get it checked out. And when he's there, there's this man who he doesn't interact with, but who's upstairs at the shop. And he hears this squeaking of the driver's prosthetic leg. And that triggers something in him where he feels like he knows this man from his past. That's all I'm going to say. And what unfolds is this deep dark look into the past of that country, into forgiveness, into confronting your past and the country's past and who someone really is. It really, really knocked me out. So I think it's a great Palme d'Or winner. And I think that you'll really like It Was Just an Accident too. Sometimes where a director feels like they have something that they need to say can be really long. And this is not. This is under 2 hours. It is, I think, very brisk and very riveting as it goes. So I think you'll really like it. It's kind of one of those quieter thrillers. So that one I would definitely recommend.
Yeah, it's 100 minutes. I saw a Jafar Panahi film at Venice. I think I mentioned this with Bennett, or I at least saw it with Bennett. This was No Bears. And at the time, he was jailed in Iran. Mm-hmm. And he is known for being a director who secretly shoots his films and is in active resistance to the Iranian regime. The women in this film don't wear hijabs, which is a huge political movement happening, which was also seen in last year's The Seat of the Sacred Fig and all of the protests happening in that country. So I think as a collective, we've seen a few Iranian directors. These two included also Asghar Farhadi, who directed A Hero and A Separation. They direct these extremely unsettling and traumatic and political films. And I think that's because they're a product of this oppressive state of their country. And him calling for solidarity and resisting the regime in his Palme d'Or speech is incredibly important and powerful. And I think the products that they've made with their films, the fact that you really love this movie, that you think I will too, I'm very excited for it. They're tough experiences because you're just so on edge the whole time. But I think their process for creating this kind of art is also really incredible.
Absolutely. And it'll definitely play, like, I would be shocked if it didn't play at New York Film Festival. So mm-hmm. we can see it together there for sure, because I have to see it again. I keep thinking about it. The next one I'll talk about is actually in a different section. So the others will also be in competition, but I loved Mirrors Number 3. This is by Christian Petzold, who is one of my favorite filmmakers working today. This was in the director's fortnight section of the festival. And if you love Christian Petzold, or if you haven't checked out his films before, I highly recommend Phoenix, Transit, A Fire, so many great movies. And I really love them all. So I kind of knew I would like this, but just sitting there in that theater, it really clicked with me from the first frame until the very last. It kind of feels like, to me, a combination of Hitchcock and Hans Christian Andersen, this mm-hmm. weird, spooky fairy tale that feels a bit unsettling and something that Hitchcock would have made. And I think he has a Hitchcockian sensibility to him for sure. But this film, it's about this woman who she's very depressed. Like, you can just tell she's not doing well at the moment. And she and her boyfriend are on this trip and they get into a car accident, and the car accident ends up killing him and leaving her with not even a scratch. But she ends up meeting this woman named Betty, who lives in this farmhouse, who she asks to stay with, even though she's not injured, and she starts taking care of her. And you start to learn more about Betty's past and why she's taking such good care of this woman, Laura. Mm-hmm. And why Laura is also mysteriously kind of finding herself in this relationship, in this house. It has this mysterious quality that I think all of his films do. It's very sad, but very beautiful. So I really enjoyed that one too. I have no idea when it's going to come out. It does have a U.S. distributor. It's going to be distributed by Metrograph Pictures. So I think we can count on seeing it here at some point, whether that's in the fall or maybe early next winter or spring when it gets a release date.
Yeah, I really like all of Petzold's previous films. I rewatched Phoenix recently. Barbara also is well known. So I'm looking forward to this one. Yeah, Metrograph Pictures is maybe a smaller, more independent mm-hmm. distributor, but they've also had some wonderful films. So I'm looking forward to that one.
I also predictably loved Kelly Reichardt's new film, The Mastermind, starring Josh O'Connor and Alana Haim. I really love all of Kelly Reichardt's films. I think if you vibe with her, typically, if you like her slow burn style, the way she looks at characters who are kind of on the fringe or on the edge of something, you'll really like this. Josh O'Connor is peak Elliot Gould here. I know I made that comparison with him for Challengers, but here, wow. The patterned button downs and the flares and the corduroys and just being generally a mess, it works so well for him. But he plays this guy named J.B. Mooney. Alana Haim plays his wife. They have two boys, and he wants to put together this small-scale art heist. He wants to steal these paintings by Arthur Dove from his local art museum. And as you could imagine with a Kelly Reichardt film, this isn't Ocean's 11. It does not build up and up and up to this big heist. The heist happens within the first 20, 25 minutes. And then the rest of it is really about the aftermath. It's about this character study. It's this slice of life. And it all takes place during the Vietnam War. So that's kind of looming large over JB and his activities. And I really loved it. I thought this was so much fun. And, you know, if you're not a fan of Kelly Reichardt, I could see you thinking this was maybe a little slow moving, but she's so good at, you know, making films where nothing really happens and yet you feel like absolutely everything in the world has happened by the end. And that's how I felt with this one.
It sounds similar to La Chimera and what you loved about that. No surprise here that you love a Kelly Reichardt film with Alana Haim and Josh O'Connor.
It's like made in a lab for me.
Exactly. This is probably more your speed than mine, but we shall see.
Yeah, I would be willing to bet that. And I think maybe for the next one too, although I'm very curious what you'll think of this. And that is Masha Shalinsky's Sound of Falling. So this was a film I saw very early in the festivals, like the second day maybe. This is a story about four girls who live in the same house in Germany across centuries. So four generations of girls that all occupy the same space. It has a very experimental, audacious style, so it doesn't move chronologically. It jumps around from different generations. It uses first-person POV. It has one of the greatest uses of Steadicam I've seen in a very long time. And it reminded me a lot of Sofia Coppola and her work, especially The Virgin Suicides. But I would also say it felt like Jonathan Glazer's films too. So this is the second time I'm invoking the zone of interest here. But I think that it's a film that keeps you at a distance at points and also pulls you in so close that you really can't help but just feel exactly what these women are going through at other points. It's very, very bleak, but I can't really think of an exploration of girlhood quite like this. It felt completely new and different. And I think that's, you know, what I'm looking for from some of these movies at Cannes. You want to see things that feel brand new and different. And what Masha Shalinsky said was that she and her writer, they were, you know, looking at pictures, like old pictures, and thinking about old houses. And they just got this idea of, are there links between girls from the early 1900s to the present day? Even though a lot has changed from then to the modern day, there have to be experiences that are just universally shared. And what are those? How do they come about? And are there things that are inherited or passed down? So I'm excited for people to see this one. And I'm curious what you'll think of it. I really don't know.
I'm intrigued by the structure. I do like this sort of anthology yet connected sort of piece. There's another one at the festival that reminded me of this a little bit that I'm very excited for. I have no idea if it'll be a 1 or a 5-star experience for me, but that is Resurrection by Gan, who famously, Cate Blanchett's favorite comfort film is his version of Long Day's Journey Into Night. It has this 50-plus minute one take. It's also in 3D. I haven't seen this. I am really excited to, but it's this movie about no one can dream anymore except for this android, and this woman is in a state of unconsciousness and she's trying to unfurl what the dreams mean and what's true, and that all sounds wild to me. And apparently it's this wonderful ode to the past century of cinema, and the cinematography is insane, the production design, the colors. There is a teaser out, I believe. I haven't seen that yet, but just sounds like an experience. And some of these movies that you see at festivals are just that. Whether they're good or bad or shown wide or not, that's kind of what you go in for. And I like being able to see some of those films and not just going to see, you know, the biggest ones of the year or what the award getters are. It's seeing unique films that you'll never see anywhere else. So I will absolutely check out Sound of Falling, whether I like it or not, you know.
Yeah. Well, and this one was also just acquired by Mubi for North American distribution. So I think it should hopefully have an awards push this year. Germany tends to do well in that category. And with Resurrection, yeah, I also love his version of Long Day's Journey and Tonight. So a thing that Kate Blanchett and I have in common. Amazing. But I actually missed this one because it didn't work with my schedule. And I hope that it goes to New York Film Festival so I can see it there at a good time, because this was one of those, it's long, it's almost 3 hours, and it was playing at 10:30 p.m. Cannes, and I just thought, that's not going to work for me, and neither is the one at 8 a.m., so I'm going to save this for later. But I'm also really excited because it has these really divisive reactions, one stars and five stars, and whenever a film gets that, that's when I really want to see it.
Oh, yeah.
And my last one, so I saved the best for last, sentimental value. I wouldn't be surprised if when we do our top movies of 2025 episode at the end of the year, this is still in my number one spot.
Well, exciting.
And we have a PTA movie coming out, so I know it's possible that that could move, but I cannot even tell you the hold that this movie had on me from the beginning. So this is, of course, by Joachim Trier, and he made The Worst Person in the World with Renata Rensvi, who we love. We love that movie. It feels kind of like the older sister film to that one. So I saw The Worst Person in the World the last time I went to Cannes, so 2021. I was on the verge of turning 30, and I just felt very aligned with Julie and her experiences and what she was going through. And in this one, Renata plays this woman named Nora, who is in her early 30s. And I was like, what is going on with this man? He's just seeing into my brain every time I come to this festival. So if I go again in a few years, she's going to be starring in another another movie. But this is about this woman named Nora. She's a stage actress, and she and her sister, their mother passes away. And that brings their estranged father, Gustav, back into their lives. He is a filmmaker who prioritized filmmaking and art over their childhood, basically. And he hasn't made a movie in 15 years, but he has written a new screenplay, and he's written the role for Nora. And he offers it to her. She turns it down. He still wants to make the project anyway, and he ends up getting inspired again by this American actress, Rachel Kemp, who goes to a retrospective of his films and just falls in love. And that actress is, of course, played by Elle Fanning. So he gives her the part, and the project changes, basically. Now it's in English for her. It has this different feel because his daughter isn't playing the part that he wrote specifically for her. And it is just such an emotional, I think, beautiful story about the power of art, of family, of relationships, and how those relationships change over time. And the house that they live in, so everything takes place pretty much in their family home, which is this big, beautiful Victorian house in Oslo. The opening to this film is my favorite thing. So he's very good at ending movies, and the ending to this is, it's great, but the beginning really took my breath away. It's pretty stunning. It's like a very sophisticated, formal exercise yet it's full of feeling for these characters and creating this world that is their family home that really, really stuck with me. And I cried so hard during this movie that I had trouble leaving when it was over. I just, it was not good. But yeah, it's my favorite movie of the festival for sure. And like I said, I wouldn't be that shocked if it stayed in my number one spot for the rest of the year. It reminded me a lot of Bergman movies, if Bergman was a little bit more hopeful, or some like 70s Woody Allen movies too. I thought it was just really, really well done and lived up to all of my expectations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm so glad it didn't disappoint. Joaquin Trier really doesn't. Did you end up watching Oslo August 31st?
I did. And I like The Worst Person in the World and Sentimental Value more.
It's very bleak.
That one's also very sad, but it doesn't have the warmth that the other two have.
Yeah.
Because this one is sad, but it just makes you feel in a way that, and I'm going to bring up one of my other favorite films, that Ordinary People makes me feel. I don't know. It just feels like a very real examination of personal relationships, mental health, grief that I really connected with. But it doesn't feel cold at all.
I think this still stands as my most anticipated then. So hopefully we hear about a release soon, because this also is being distributed by Neon, also with It Was Just an Accident, Neon becoming the quick sponsor of Cannes, potentially.
I know.
They just seem to pick up all of the big films coming.
Neon, it's funny because I know that, you know, when we were at Cannes, like Neon came into the festival with Sentimental Value and Julia Ducournau's follow-up to Titan, Alpha. And then as the festival kept going, they just kept buying more movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I know people were joking and talking about how, oh my God, they really want the Palme d'Or. They want to get a sixth one. They are just, you know, making sure they buy all of the possible contenders. But I recommend listening to the IndieWire podcast, where Anne Thompson interviews Tom Quinn, the CEO of Neon. And he seems just like he's very competitive and he wants the best movies. And I think he thought a lot of the films here were some of the best international films in particular, I think, that we'll see all year. So I'll say it's good that they picked up some of these, especially because they have Alpha, which I will talk about in a second. But I do have some other recommendations for you of things I think you'll like. Two that I saw in certain regard are Pillion and The Plague. Have you heard anything about these two?
Just Pillion. That was Alexander Skarsgård's like big leather boot debut on the red carpet,
yes.
Right?
And yep.
All I saw so far is it's an X-rated BDSM film. That's all I know. So yikes, but like cool.
Okay. That makes it sound like it's really shocking, and I will say it's not. It's okay. Just, I thought it was really sweet, actually. I was surprised at how sweet it was.
Okay.
And I think it's a pretty delightful comedy, too, with Harry Melling and Alexander Skarsgård. And yes, like BDSM and dom-sub relationships like are at the center. That's what the film is about. But I was surprised just by how, yeah, sweet it was. It's different than what you think it will be, I think, when it starts. And then The Plague is about these boys at a water polo camp and the different factions that they create and what happens when you're that age, like middle school age, and just how, oh, these boys, they're so mean to each other. It is this very intense experience, and I would be curious what you think. And the child actors are all really good. So I wanted to shout out those because those are two from the sidebar sections. But the ones I need your reactions on are some big ones. So the first is Highest to Lowest. This is Spike Lee's reimagining of High and Low, which we just talked about last week on the show. And I just want to know what you think of it. I am not going to say much about it, I think, other than that. When it started out, and this is, of course, it's starring Denzel Washington in the main role and then A$AP Rocky. He's in the kidnapper role. And, you know, instead of it being a shoe company, Denzel is a record producer. He owns his own label, Stack and Hits Records. the way this film starts out, I thought, oh no, we are in for a rough ride. I think you have to get past like maybe the first 20 minutes or so and really get on its wavelength. And then I think it becomes a really fun, interesting New York movie that makes a lot of changes to the original. So it's definitely not trying to be the same type of movie that High and Low is. It uses it very much as a loose skeleton. And I think by the end, I had a really good time with it. But yeah, I'm curious what you think.
I was worried maybe because it wasn't really in contention for any awards from the festival. And just because of how much I love High and Low. So I think that's a good introduction or a warning of not going into that movie expecting Kurosawa's vision and maybe just enjoying the Spike Lee spectacle of it all, maybe. Mm-hmm. So that's good. Yeah.
I think, like I told you before, you have to just get High and Low off the brain before you go into it, because it's completely different. The other one I'm curious what you'll think of is Nouvelle Vague. This is the Richard Linklater movie about the making of Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless. If you're looking for the movie to tell you why I think Breathless is great or an important film or anything like that, I don't think that's necessarily what this film does. It is, I think, just a really delightful hangout film. Like Richard Linklater is so good at making, I think he thrives in the hangout film genre. And this one just happens to take place during the French New Wave. So he introduces, you know, all of these different players from the time. And I think what's cool about it is that all of the actors are virtually unknowns or newcomers and look a lot like their counterparts. The actor who plays Truffaut could be his grandson or something. It's wild how similarly they look. And it reminded me actually a lot of Midnight in Paris and just how they introduce the different characters. But it took me by surprise because I wasn't sure what I would think of it. But I don't really think it's taking itself too seriously. It's not trying to be this like grand look at why Godard is important or anything like that. It's just, I think, recreating that time period.
That sounds like New Age Linklater, is that he's having fun. It's not high stakes, but I do like that he's looking back at the history of cinema, looking at the French New Wave and this production. This is widely seen in every French film class. And yeah, I don't know. I didn't love the teaser. I felt like it was too on the nose for the New Wave, but I'm glad that you liked it. And I'm intrigued, absolutely, for more, getting a longer trailer or just seeing how it plays out. Yeah.
The next one is Die My Love. This is from Lynn Ramsey and stars Robert Pattinson, Jennifer Lawrence, Sissy Spacek, based on Ariana Harwick's novel. And I want you to see this mainly for Jennifer Lawrence's performance, because I'm actually surprised she didn't win Best Actress at Cannes. I mean, I think sometimes they just go their own way and they'll pick someone from a movie that doesn't have distribution yet, or they'll pick someone who isn't a big star. But this is the type of performance that I think demands attention. It reminded me a lot of her role in Mother, actually, in what she's doing.
That was my question.
I think it's closest to Mother, but I think what's cool about the performance is that there are stretches of this movie where nothing is really happening. Like, she is just alone in her house in remote Montana taking care of this baby. But she keeps you entertained with what she is doing. And just hearing her speak about this character and how motherhood has changed her as an actor and its influence on the film is really interesting. Visually, it's really beautiful too and takes a lot of risks. So I think you'll like it, but I'm curious. It lost me a little bit by the end, but it's one that has stayed with me quite a bit since the festival.
These are mostly for vibes. I'm excited for both of their performances and hearing her speak, about dancing naked or whatever scene that was and just going for it. Yeah, it sounds like a wild kind of film. And that is some of Ramsey's work. So yeah, this, I mean, I will go see any Jennifer Lawrence film, mostly if it's not David O. Russell, but I'm excited for this.
It's definitely, I think, a performance that we'll be talking about for the year ahead, too. Mm-hmm. Like, even though the film itself I don't consider to be Oscar-friendly, I think her performance will definitely strike a chord with actors. And then the last one is The History of Sound. So this is the period drama romance starring Paul Mescal and Josh O'Connor. It is very restrained, yet very beautiful, but I don't know if you will like it or not. I'm curious. So in it, they play musicians who are traveling together to record folk songs across the U.S. around World War I. And I think it had this quiet beauty to it and this restraint. But for people listening, if you're looking for Josh O'Connor and Paul Mescal sex scenes, you're not going to get them. I'm just breaking it to you.
I figured we weren't. This wasn't necessarily near the top of my list as anticipated from the festival. I'm definitely open to hearing more about it and seeing more, but I think I just mostly loved Paul Mescal's response to a critic comparing this to Brokeback Mountain and him just flatly denying that comparison. But how was their chemistry together?
They have good chemistry. I was surprised, I think, at how supporting Josh's role is. Like, it's not really a two-hander for a lot of the movie. I mean, they are together for good chunks of it, and they do have good chemistry there, but I think it's really Paul Mescal's character's story. But when they are together, great chemistry.
So what about some maybe not so hot movies that you saw?
Yeah. I did not care for Eddington, Ari Aster's COVID movie. So this takes place in May 2020. And I think part of it, you know, could have been it felt too soon for me, but it felt really inert. None of the characters feel like characters. They don't feel like real people. They just feel like memes, honestly. Mm. Like, they're just kind of regurgitating everything that we remember from that time. Mm-hmm. It's like every possible thing you remember from May 2020 is in this movie. Antifa, the black Instagram square, masks, social distancing. Like, it's all just there to be there. And it was hard for me to really see a point to it. He doesn't really say much, I don't think, with it. So I kind of felt like it was an interminable experience because I don't want to relive that time unless there's a point to reliving that time. And when I watched this, there was not a point to be found. I did think that Joaquin Phoenix actually gave a really good performance. Unfortunately, Austin Butler and Emma Stone are completely underused. They are maybe in it for 15, 20 minutes, and it's over 2 hours.
Interesting.
And Austin Butler is pretty great as this cult leader. He's kind of like a QAnon type. And Emma Stone was giving Sissy Spacek and Piper Laurie vibes from Carrie. And I wanted more of that. I thought, this is maybe the space she needs to be in. I want a character like this again in another movie, because I thought they were just completely underutilized, unfortunately. Mm. And Pedro Pascal, too. I thought he was great, but it's really the Joaquin Phoenix show.
Yeah.
And he does carry the role very well. But again, not much really happens.
Yeah, that's disappointing. But yeah. Widely negative reviews. So I'm not maybe surprised that you didn't like it either. I'm very mixed on Aster of late. So this doesn't help that.
Yeah. But by far, my biggest disappointment of the festival was Alpha. This is an endless loop of suffering. It does not let up at all, but it also doesn't make sense. So that's the other problem with it is, like, after you see the movie, if you try to talk to people about it and you think, wait, did this mean this? Or was this an allegory for this? Or you try to make sense of the different parts of the film, it isn't like one of those great ambiguous films where you think, oh, what did this all mean? Or what's your interpretation of it? It's not that. It's just sheer confusion over the narrative, because she, it doesn't seem like she really knows what she wants to say with this either. And I didn't really like the performances. I think Tahar Rahim is the best in the show. He plays the main character, Alpha, her uncle, who is really addicted to drugs. So it's a very intense performance. But I think she's playing with a lot here, and just none of it worked for me, unfortunately. So I don't know how much you know about it, but basically this girl, Alpha, she comes home from a party where she got a tattoo. And she has this tattoo of an A on her arm, which of course recalls Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter. They don't really do much with that in the movie, but it's a problem because there's a disease going around that's spread through needles. And her mom is a doctor, and she's really worried that Alpha picked this up through this needle. So it is an AIDS allegory, but it's also dealing with a lot of extra stuff that doesn't totally make sense. And there is not a single glimmer of hope in this movie. It is just exhausting. But I think that was kind of the consensus out of the festival, was that it was a pretty dreadful follow-up to winning the Palme d'Or.
Yeah, it's thinking of Ra or Titan and at least finding sense through the gruesomeness that she portrays. And that sounds interesting, you know, that introduction to it, but sad that it doesn't go anywhere or say much. And I think we have to talk about awards potential, Oscars bound films or performances. I think the consensus is that sentimental value will be up for multiple awards. I think that stems from Neon, like I mentioned earlier, having multiple films. So I think we can definitely talk about international feature, whether it's winners or others included. And then I think bigger categories above the lines with sentimental value potentially. What performances you think could be up in different categories? Because last year we saw Emilia Perez, you know, the actress winners. Zoe Saldana went on to win, and that movie obviously garnered a lot of nominations. So we always have these big players that will show up no matter what, and we're bound to have some of these. I think from your praise and critics' praise from the festival, absolutely included.
Yeah, I think, and you know, the big story last year too was Anora really was the big breakout hit of Cannes, right? And that was the movie that everyone loved from Cannes. And this year, I mean, the film with, we joke about standing ovations all the time at Cannes, but the movie with the biggest standing ovation and I think the most praise on the ground was Sentimental Value. So I think that that is Neon's big player, and it's very early, but I think Stellan Skarsgård has a chance to be nominated and even to win supporting actor. I think it's such a big role. He's playing Gustav, the director, in it, and he has a lot to do, and I could see the campaign for him being really strong. So I think he has a lot of promise. I think Trier could get into director. It could be really strong in international feature. Screenplay again, after The Worst Person in the World was nominated. Picture, Renata Rinsvi in actress. It's a wonderful ensemble, so I could just see it, I think, going really far. And it's one that I think makes you feel a lot. And the Academy likes the movies that make you feel something, and this is definitely one of those. And it's really well made, too. I think also, I mean, if we're thinking about international feature, and like you were talking about Neon, Neon has the potential really to snag quite a few spots in this category. So they also have It Was Just an Accident, which I think, you know, being the Palme d'Or winner, they could really campaign that well. And maybe even Panahi could get into director. I don't know. That would be really cool. They also have The Secret Agent, which played really well. I was not as high on that as some people. I thought it was good, but it wasn't one of my favorites that I saw at the festival. But, you know, that being a director and actor winner, I think it could also benefit from what I'm Still Here did last year. And while I think I'm Still Here is a stronger film, this movie is tackling really similar issues through a different lens. So I think that that could also do really well. But these are all neon too, so I'm curious how they're going to do these, how they're going to stagger release dates, if they're going to hold anything. I don't know. But I think there's a lot of potential definitely there in international categories. And I mentioned Jennifer Lawrence. I think if she gets into actress, which is, I think, very, very possible considering the gravity of that performance, the type of the performance, the fact that she's a previous winner, I do think she'll be a lone nominee from that film. I can't really see anything else happening, but I think she's very strong. And then I also am curious about History of Sound, just because this is an AARP Movies for Grownups Award contender. There are sections of this movie that feel very BBC, almost Downton Abbey, like period-like.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I think it could hit with a certain audience, but again, it really depends on the release, and it could also be one of those films, though, that just gets a few maybe notices throughout the year, but I can't really see it having that much passion. Mm-hmm. But still, I just wanted to flag it because I did watch it and think this is a very particular type of film that I think certain people will really, really like.
Well, we know that Paul Mescal can't be up for an AARP award, but I heard some praise for June Squibb in Scarlett Johansson's Eleanor the Great. So maybe she has a chance at certain actress awards throughout the season. And she was up for Thelma this past year for certain prizes too along the way. Not at the Oscars, obviously, but hopefully we'll see a bit of her again on the red carpet because she's always a joy.
She is. And yeah, I'd be curious about Nouvelle Vague too, just because this is very beautiful visually. The cinematography is stunning. The costumes, like it looks like it was ripped right from that time. So I think it could be a crafts contender.
What about some other ones that you're excited for? I know you mentioned Resurrection that you weren't able to see. Is there anything else that is still high on your list?
Yeah, so I unfortunately wasn't able to see Urchin, Harris Dickinson's directorial debut. It got really strong reviews, a lot of comparisons to Mike Leigh's film Naked, which I'm a big fan of. So I'm really eager to see this one. Again, the timing just doesn't work out. And I'm sure you remember the horrors and the stress of the ticketing system at Cannes.
Oh, yeah.
And this was just one I couldn't get a ticket for first go, and it didn't work. So I'm hoping to catch that at some point. Left-Handed Girl, also, which this was part of the Critics Week section. Sean Baker is also a co-writer on the film, producer, and editor. And I just heard really good things. But again, because it was Critics Week section, there were limited screenings and tickets, and I couldn't get one. So I'm hoping to see it at some point soon. But I've heard it's similar to The Florida Project. And then also Surratt. So this is one actually that I haven't seen, but maybe if I had, I would put it on the list that I think you would like. I saw it compared to Mad Max meets Climax. I am not a fan of Gaspar Noé, as you know. So I don't know if I will like it, but just based on the divisive reactions, I do want to see it.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great. Any high adrenaline experience is always fun. So if it lives up to either of those movies or even a fraction of them, I think that would be very interesting. And it was tied for the jury prize. So there was some general consensus that it deserved to win. So that's great.
Yeah, I'm hoping to catch all of those at some point. They're just, it's always funny, like you start a film festival or when it was the first day of Cannes, I thought, I'm going to see all these movies in competition, so many of these extra things. And then you get going and it's like, okay, but when am I going to eat? How can I walk from this theater to this one that quickly? Am I booking things on top of each other? And you start to get a little bit overwhelmed. So I did see quite a few movies. I saw a lot actually, but there's still some that I'm eager to see them whenever that may be.
You quickly learn that you can't live on espresso and protein bars for very long, especially for more than a week. So yeah, priorities are important, and we have plenty of time to see all of these. You were speaking of co-production earlier, and I just wanted to mention, because it was just an accident, is obviously an Iranian film along with Panahi himself, but it was a co-production with France and Luxembourg. So there is some big potential for that to show up in international as a submission of one of those other countries, which is great. Final question for you. I think this could be very hard. If you could give any movie you saw at Cannes one Oscar or performance, what would it be?
This is really, really hard. And I'm going to give Sentimental Value Best Picture.
Ugh, wonderful.
Yeah, I feel like it is just so well made. I love every performance in it, the writing, the direction, the cinematography, the music, everything about it. And I will give it my Best Picture Oscar.
Oh, that's so exciting. I was curious if you would do that, so I'm glad you did. This was incredible hearing about your experience. It's made me so much more excited for these films and certain ones in particular. So I'm glad you got to talk about them and ones you liked, ones you didn't like. Many that we will see throughout the year. And as they release, as we do seasonal previews, roundups, we can talk about these and their releases so everyone can see them.
Yeah, I'm glad I got to go to Cannes again and just see all these movies. It's such a wonderful, thrilling experience, and I feel really lucky that I was able to go again. But next time on Oscar Wilde, we have a really fun episode planned. This will be a Patreon episode, but we'll do a preview on our main show. So, in honor of Celine Song's Materialists coming up later in June, we will be doing a Dakota Johnson After Dark special. We will be doing a Luca Guadagnino double, watching A Bigger Splash and Suspiria.
We already covered Madame Web on Patreon on After Dark, so go listen to that. But I'm still excited for her performance in Splitsville, but absolutely for Celine Song's Materialists and her performance there. That will be out soon, and we are going to do a release on that the following week. So stay tuned for that. Thank you all for listening. Feel free to rate, review, and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Blue Sky, and TikTok. You can find bonus content on our Patreon at patreon.com/OscarWilde, including a longer version of that next episode and previous ones we've released on the main feed.
Thank you all for listening. See you next time.